Okay, should be ready, James.
This is Jim Backus. I'm speaking for the Heritage Education Commission of Morehead State University. It is December the 1st, 1988, and I'm visiting with Boyd Christensen of WDAY Radio in Fargo. Boyd, I see you in several guises. I see you as a TV anchor man. I see you as a radio talk show man. I see you as a fundraiser. I see you as a good master of ceremonies. And I see you as a stand-up comic. I see you in several guises.
I'm guilty as charged. That's a good summation. That is a good description of what I do. I have, as we talk now, I'm in my 38th year in broadcasting. I started when I was 15 as a record spinner at a station called KLPM in Minot. And I had a program called Music Off the Record. Played 78s, Jim, that'll tell you when it was, back in about 1950, 51, around in there. Graduated from that to a 10-minute sportscast every afternoon at 5 for a few weeks until the sportscaster that I replaced, named Russ Smith, a legendary figure in North Dakota sports, who's in the Sportscasters Hall of Fame, settled a salary disagreement with the station and came back, and I was on the streets out of my first sports job to working at a couple of stations at the University of North Dakota when I was in school there in the 50s, KFJM, the campus radio station. Later did some part-time work at KNOX Radio. For $1.25 an hour, I spun records starting at 11 o'clock Saturday morning, 11 a.m., went around the clock to 1 in the morning. You're talking 14 hours. I'd have a huge stack. By then, I graduated from 78s to 45s, playing these records, reading an occasional commercial in between, and a marvelous, another legendary figure in North Dakota broadcasting named David Henley, who was the program director at KNOX when I was there from 55 to 59. Dave first came into prominence working with Manny Marguette at a station called WDAY in Fargo back in the late 1920s. And Dave was in the twilight of a wonderful career, and he would twice during that shift take time to drive out to a place up the road on the State Mill Road in Grand Forks called Jacoby's Hamburger Heaven, and pick me up a monster, which was a large hamburger with all the trimmings and some fries and a chocolate malt, and feed me during this 14-hour record shift. $1.25 an hour, lots of money for a college student back in those days.
You, from the very first time, from the very first opportunity to think about your profession, you were thinking about radio, you were thinking about communication. When I was in grade school and high school in Jamestown, there was a young man named Roy Brandt. Roy Brandt was just like you. He had an incessant desire to get on the air, to communicate. He thought it was a great future, and he became a chef, a kind of a radio chef in Los Angeles. Changed his name, I think, slightly. Well, after what you said, I realize that you have seen certainly much of the birth of radio in this country, and certainly the birth and growth of television. I was thinking the other day that when you were young, you possibly listened to dance programs coming from the Dome in between Bismarck and Mandan, North Dakota. And here in 1988, we're talking about a dome for NDSU in Fargo.
I guess everything, it all comes around. There's really nothing new we have. It's bigger and better, new and improved, as the ad says. But history kind of has a way of repeating itself. My 53 years, as I speak to you now, in this state, the growth of broadcasting, to have a ringside seat, gives you not only a ringside seat to the industry in which you work, but to what happens in the state, because I worked as a sports reporter, I worked as a newsman, as a disc jockey, a radio talk show host, and so the things you talk about And the grist for your mill, as you know as a reporter yourself, Jim, is what's happening in our state. Good things, bad things, progressive things, shocking things, sad things, weather stories, happy stories. So not only is it a profession where if you enjoy meeting and talking to people and working crazy hours and working on holidays and doing 14-hour record shifts and eating hamburgers in between, it's a ringside seat to history as it unfolds, not only in our state, but all across the world and the country. It's like you remember where you were when Kennedy was shot, for example, in 1963. Your reaction to the, even though you were just a kid, to the Truman-Dewey upset in 48. Ringside seat to the, maybe a closer look at what the candidates are doing in elections than the average voter has, because as a reporter, you are privy to some little things that don't always get reported and little insights. And that's the exciting part about this field I'm in. And I've always been a very, very curious person. I love to do interviews. I did an interview program for some years on public television called, ironically, Boyd Christensen Interviews. Someone says, you're a very good interviewer. How do you become that? I said, the first thing is you have to be very nosy or strike that word and make it curious, because it's probably a better word. I'm extremely curious. And if I were, say, interviewing you now, and I'm sitting here with a microphone in my hand, there are many questions I would love to ask Jim Backus, because you've had a ringside seat. And I guess if what makes a good interviewer is I am genuinely interested in what the person is going to tell me. When I ask a question, I sometimes don't know the answer. Like an attorney says, never ask a question in a courtroom unless you already know the answer. I've seen interviewers who are frightened out of doing a good interview because they won't ask a question unless they already know the answer. They don't want to be surprised by it. And I know the answer to many questions before I ask them. But the best ones are the ones I don't know the answer to, and I'm genuinely interested. And that has been a very integral part of my career. I still do it occasionally on a radio talk show I do today called Viewpoint, where people call in, and all of a sudden I'll start interviewing. So I said, tell me more about that. Tell me your reaction. What are you feeling right now? I'm a very curious person. So it's a marvelous way to make a living. And the spinoffs on it, you mentioned MC work. I've done a lot of MC work. I do a lot of speaking at dinners and banquets all across the state and into Minnesota, even into South Dakota. And I can make them laugh, which I do most of the time. I can be serious and motivational if that's what they want, because I can. And I only share stories about myself. That's the only thing I'm an expert on, and I'm not as much an expert on myself as I wish I was sometimes. So the public speaking, I probably do between emceeing and speaking maybe 60 a year. That's more than one a week, and I don't do any in the summertime, so I can be kept busy doing that. And that I enjoy, because as opposed to talking on the radio or on television, I could be in a room where anywhere from 50 to 800 people, as I was once at the Civic Auditorium in Grand Forks, 890 people for a speech, and to look across the sea of faces and watch their face kind of get sad when I tell a sad story, and watch their eyes light up and watch them smile when I tell a funny story. You can't do that when you're on radio and TV. You hope they're enjoying you at that moment. But I like the public speaking because I know right then, as I say, I know immediately whether I'm bombing or not. I don't have to wait for the next day's mail for someone to write me and say, I didn't like your show yesterday or last week. I know immediately, and there's an immediacy about that that I thoroughly enjoy.
Have you done any theater work as a kid, as a high school? Were you interested in legitimate theater, for example, in connection with your lively interest, obviously, in radio?
One of my first heroes, I think we all have heroes, people who teach us, people who we admire. And I greatly admired a dramatics instructor at Minot High School, where I grew up, named Bill Robinson, and he got me interested in drama. First of all, I took a couple of speech classes from him, and I had aptitude for that. I enjoyed getting, I was a class clown, so now I can get up and give a speech and tell funny stories or do whatever in a 10-minute speech and get credit for it rather than being booted out of class for being disruptive. And we did plays. He got me interested in plays and theater. And I did quite a bit of that in high school. I didn't have time in college because I was working my way through school as a busboy, doing odd jobs, doing record pantomimes. Remember the record lip-syncing, they call it. I did Spike Jones and Stan Freberg records. I'd put on funny hats, have a prop guitar or whatever else, and I would lip sync and coordinate my movements to a record, a little 45 I had in a portable record player that I paid $17 for, a speaker that I bought on time for $26, one speaker on little places like Red Lake Falls, Minnesota, and Hallock, Minnesota, where I'd go and do this for anywhere from $5 to $10 to $15. Did those things. So working my way through school, I didn't have time to be in plays. It took a lot of time. And then a community theater in Fargo, only done one. Did Plaza Suite back about in the late 1960s, I believe it was. I was in Act 3, and I was Mr. Hubley, the father of the bride, who, as you know, Jim, locked herself in the bathroom and spent the entire act trying to get Mimsy out of the bathroom. Opening night, it's funny how these memories come back now as we're talking. Opening night, I was working with a lovely lady named Linda Russell. She was my wife. Two of us on stage for about an hour, just two of us interacting, and most of my lines are delivered to, and my actions are to, a locked bathroom door. And I was really getting into it on opening night, and I'm pounding on the door, and it came open. The prop door swung open. I'll never forget, Linda looked at me and very quickly looked away like she hadn't noticed. Like, oh, I better not notice that the door is open or I will have to say something. And what that told me was, you're on your own, Buster, and the crowd is just in a frenzy because the whole plot is to get the door open. 7 minutes into the play, I've got the door open, and they're laughing. And I thought, okay, bright boy, you're going to have to come up with an ad lib or something. You've got to say something here or we could lose the whole night. So I thought, what can it be? And I was just racking my brain, and the laughter finally died down because they, too, thought, he's going to have to say something. What do you suppose he's going to say? I grabbed the door when the laughter died down. I pulled it closed, and all I said was, and keep it closed as far as I'm concerned. And case closed, see? Well, that was the opening night. For the next 6 or 7 nights, the word got around, and you'd hear the whisper go through the audience as we approached that part of the act. And the whisper in the crowd would be, this is where the door came open on Friday night. Those kinds of things. And it also, as we ramble here, I don't remember what your original question was, but I hope I gave you a good answer to whatever it was, Jim.
Well, certainly we've seen the growth of radio and communication. And I want to ask you about your sense of the future of the communication industry, and we'll say in the upper Midwest. But I remember that when I went into the Air Corps, was in the Air Corps in 1942, I was in special services, and they came up with a wire recorder, a piece of wire. And we were trying to do various kinds of interviews with like local radio stations. So we went down to the radio station in Las Vegas, which was KENO. I think it's still on, a small coffee pot station. And we set up spinning 78s. We called it Sack Time Serenade from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. each night. And that was, I guess, the beginning in that part of the country, you know. The 78s were available through the local music store. What is your feeling about the industry in the upper Midwest, speaking of radio and television, and many of the other changes that are coming in communication today? It has sent shivers through the great monstrous networks, and it has just changed the scene for someone like you and someone like myself interested in the industry.
I guess there's so many facets in the answer. The first thing comes to mind is the audience is so fractured now. When I started in this market in Fargo, North Dakota in 1964, there were 3 commercial channels, CBS, ABC, NBC, and public television in its infancy locally, not a quality product at all, and the audience wasn't even measurable in surveys. It was just beginning. There were 5 or 6, four radio stations. There was no FM, and of course the local paper. Give you some idea, our news, weather, and sports on WDAY television, myself as sports, Marv Bostert doing the news, Dewey Berquist doing the weather. At our peak, from about 64 till almost 1970, give or take, we commanded at 6 o'clock and at 10 o'clock for our local news, weather, and sports anywhere from 68 to 72% of the audience. It was unheard of. Broadcast Magazine, kind of one of the Bibles of the industry, published a survey, a nationwide survey. For per capita share of audience, WDAY in Fargo was number one in the United States. The Columbia School of Journalism recruited journalism students at the colleges in our area to monitor WDAY and write papers as to why were we getting such a large share of the audience. Well, I like to think we did a good job. I like to think that the other channels had not kept pace at that time. I think we were doing a better job. But now, as we talk, Jim, 24 years later, I can go home tonight and turn on my television with cable, and I can watch about 22 channels. I can watch two or three animal shows. I've got a 24-hour news station. I've got a 24-hour sports station. I've got a super station that'll bring me professional sports from all across the United States. What I'm saying now is the audience is fractured. Television has to reorder its priorities now, and where exactly they're going to go, I don't know, because they're losing audience. And the audience isn't going away from television. They have more choices now. One of the things that is so surprising is that radio has enjoyed a renaissance. And I'm not saying that because I am back now in radio as we talk in 1988, but talk radio, what I'm doing, is for the last at least 10 years, and maybe its peak in the last 5 years, talk radio nationwide is drawing tremendous numbers. It's the rebirth of radio. People have rediscovered radio. And I think one of the reasons they have is the kind of thing I do on radio, an hour and a half of people talking about whatever, maybe a topic, giving information. You can't find that on television anywhere. Because with a fractured audience, one of the things we have seen now to get the audience back and translate audience into ratings and translate ratings into dollars, you're getting sensational type programs. A reporter like Geraldo Rivera, who will get on a neo-Nazi spewing his hatred, a black man talking about the black movement, and a rabbi, and then be surprised when somebody, in a fight ensues and somebody picks up a chair, throws it at him, and Geraldo Rivera, and breaks his nose. Phil Donahue, a very respected man who's had a wonderful program on television for years, now with this fractured audience and to get the numbers, he appeared in a dress on his program 2 weeks ago talking about transvestites. He dressed up like a woman. 2 days later, he's talking about professional women's wrestling. And he got into a ring and wrestled with a woman. So that's the downside. Now to fight for the audience out there, they have to get sensational. Sex, violence, controversy, that's what's getting the numbers now. Sleaze, it's garbage television. And being in the business as long as I have, it's a cycle we will go through, and then something else will happen. But it was interesting, in the midst of all this, we had the 25th anniversary celebration of the death and the assassination of President Kennedy. And there were vintage footage brought out of what the major networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, did that day in Dallas, November 22nd, and the three ensuing days covering the funeral. Many feel it was television's finest hour, and that television, at that moment, took a quantum leap into the driver's seat as far as where people got their information and where they could expect excellence. And there were many journalists who watched the retrospectives just a few days ago, as we're talking now, November 30th, and said, it's too bad television can't become that again. See, we're in cycles. I think it will. But I think the fracturing of the audience has caused stations to do things that 10, 15 years from now they may not be very proud of. But it's part of the evolution process. And it may be painful. Growth always is. But I think television and talented people will get together again, and the product will be one that we can all be proud of. I hope that's what the legacy is.
Well, what we're seeing today on television is a far cry from the morning party line of a few years ago, or the afternoon party line, which you were connected with, which was graceful and interesting and fast-moving. Let's talk now about your family. Tell me something about your parents and grandparents and about your present family.
Well, I've got a... I feel like I can really identify with Alex Haley because many of my years, and as I talk, we're 53, many of my years have been spent tracking down my roots. I was born in Rugby, North Dakota in February 29th, leap year, 1936. 3 months prior, or I should say about 6 months prior to my birth in September of 1935, my mother, pregnant with me at the time, 3 months pregnant, and a sister of hers, my aunt, and the man who was my father, they were returning from Devil's Lake, North Dakota, and they had traveled there to shop for a wedding dress for my mother. She and my father were to be married. And, you know, nowadays, as we talk in the 1980s, you know, single parents, babies out of wedlock, couples living together, it's no big deal. It's commonplace. In 1935 in Pierce County in Rugby, North Dakota, for a woman to give birth and that child not to have a father or a husband in the house, the gossip was tremendous. That's what my mother went through because my father died 6 months before I was born. Ironically, you know, in that crash, my mother told me when she got out of, my aunt told me when they got out of the car, my father was killed instantly. She and my aunt were in a daze. The box holding this rather nice dress my mother had purchased had flown out of the back seat of the car in the collision, and my mother walked through the ditch to collect it. Now that. So my family didn't talk much about it, and I think you can identify this with this. We were stoic Norwegians, Scandinavians. You didn't talk about your problems. As a child, I heard this quite often. People don't want to hear about your problems. If you can't say something nice, don't say anything. We stuffed everything. It was a very traumatic experience, as you would expect from my mother and everything else. I was into my teen years before I discovered my real roots, that my father had died in an accident. I was probably in my 20s before I saw a decent picture of my father. I was almost 30 years old before I found some relatives of mine on my father's side. I was into my 30s and living in Fargo when a sister of my father, the last remaining member of that side of my family, she's the last living person still alive today, and we got together and she had a shoebox full of old negatives that she was going to throw away, and her daughter said, "Oh, Mom, don't do that." She had them all developed, and I saw scads of pictures of my father. Looked like me, and here I'm talking to his sister, and she looked at my fingers. She said, "Oh, you have fingers just like your dad. You chew your fingernails. No, your dad did that. Do you smoke?" I said, "Yeah, I smoke 3 packs a day. She said, "Your father smoked all the time, too. He had a wonderful sense of humor, and he liked to pull practical jokes, and he liked to tell stories." And a lot of the pictures of my dad, where there were 3 or 4 or 5 people in getting their pictures taken, he'd sometimes have a funny look on his face, or he'd cross his eyes, or he'd have a funny hat on. And I needed to know all these things. I had an idea. My mother has a wonderful sense of humor, but I had never known my father at all. And to get all this information 30 years after the fact was like discovering a gold mine for me, a family gold mine. So those are my immediate roots, and so I discovered a whole new family. I had people on that side of the family who had a notion about this little baby born in Pierce County 30, 40 years ago. Wonder whatever happened to that. Wonder what his name was. Now I go on. Family would say, and I dropped my last name when I worked in Pembina, North Dakota at KCND-TV back in 1960. They wanted nice short names to shoot into the big market in Winnipeg, so I became Boyd Jerome, which is my middle name. They said that, had I used the name Christensen, they may have put it together, but I was Boyd Jerome, and they said, "Gee, he looks a lot like so-and-so and so-and-so." And of course I did. I had a strong physical resemblance. They had no idea. Not until I moved to Fargo and started working under the name Boyd Christensen. You know, and doing a lot of, and my public persona really rose at that time. Then they put 2 and 2 together. That's when the lady called me. That was really interesting. My own family now, I married Marlene Huber from Devil's Lake. We met at college. I was a busboy in her sorority. I waited on her tables and washed her dirty dishes at mealtime. There were 4 of us who served meals. I filled the furnace there with the stoker with coal and hauled the ashes out in the wintertime. $15 a month for doing that. And we met in college. We married in 1959. And we have three children. Laura, who's our oldest, lives in South America. Married a young man who's a native of South America. And he's studying to be a doctor. And they have two children. We have two grandkids. Our daughter Mona is married and lives in Chicago. She's in her 20s. And her husband is studying at the University of Chicago. And she's working as a development officer at the Field Museum. And our son Mark, the youngest, is working as a physical therapist and heads up the PT department at St. John's Hospital here in Fargo. So that's our immediate immediate family.
Very interesting. You know, Boyd, you and I think are North Dakotans by choice. We're not snowbirds of any great duration, and we've heard so much, you know, about just turning little Middle West and maybe the Upper Midwest into a kind of a glorified pasture, and changing the scope and direction of the entire middle part of this country. I happen not to believe that, but I have some conviction that the future of this country, this particular territory, is good. We have what people seem to want most, fresh air, good water, and space. And I wonder what your observations are concerning this and the future of our so-called Upper Midwest. I suppose in later years, someone will run this tape, and they will either find that we're correct or that we're not. Well, what are your personal philosophic feelings about this as you, by choice, live in North and work in North Dakota?
Yes, I am here by choice. I suppose there was a time, particularly in the field I chose to work in, broadcasting, when you... like you start in Minot at a little station, then you in Grand Forks, and then you go to Pembina, and then you go to WDAY in Fargo, and then maybe you go to the Twin Cities, or you go to Chicago. And I suppose early on it was, I thought, well, if it happens, it'll happen. And I can't recall, Jim, at what point when I said, I don't want to leave North Dakota. It may have been when I was at WDAY, maybe in the late 1960s, approaching 1970, maybe in there, maybe somewhere in that span, when, and it was a conscious thing, my wife and I talked about it, and I had had a couple of offers to move on to other stations, and the money wasn't good enough at the time, and I wasn't sure I wanted to move, but I think we finally made a commitment, and I said, you know, I don't know that I ever want to leave North Dakota, Marlene, I said to my wife, and I was thinking in terms of, I wonder what her reaction will be like. If she feels I'm copping out, not working to my full potential, maybe she has some ideas of things, places she'd like to go. But we were both so pleased because her roots are in North Dakota also. So it was decided that, yes, money is, you have to have some money to do things. But Marv and Dewey and I used to talk when we'd take off on a weekend and go fishing in Minnesota and go out in a boat and have a few beers and have some fun, catch some walleyes. We'd say, boy, they can't do this in Chicago. They can't do this in New York or Detroit, hop in a car and in 45 minutes be in a pristine lake, catching fish, pine trees, fresh air, blue sky, no crowd. And we used to say, this is worth $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a year to me to live here. I'd forego that in salary I could make elsewhere for this lifestyle. So the decision was a conscious one. And it was ironic when I left WDAY in 1978, to go to public television, I got a call from KSTP Television in Minneapolis. Marvelous station, great reputation. We all knew about KSTP. There was a time when I thought I'd like to work there. That meant, boy, if I could ever get to KSTP. And they called, offered me a job. I said, you're about 5 or 6 years too late. And they said, and the guy was kind of put out. He said, this is KSTP. I said, yeah, I know. To put this into perspective, this was in 1978. This will be played a long time down the line. The job offer was $75,000 a year. I was making 20 at the time. And I said, no. Now, people will listen to this and say, Christensen was crazy. But I said, listen, you made my day. because I said, all of us who work in this business, I know it certainly applies to me. We all think, gee, that I'm a rather popular fellow here in Fargo, 50,000 people, whatever our population. I wonder how I'd go over in Minneapolis. I wonder if they'd like me in Chicago. And I wonder if they'd even want me there. And these people had seen my works. They'd gotten videotapes of me somehow, and they wanted me in Minneapolis. And I said, you made my day. I said, I don't have to go now. Just the fact that I could have gone is enough. And we will stay here. We'll spend... People used to say, have you lived in North Dakota all your life? I use this at banquets. I say, no, but I got 52 good years in. I haven't all my life yet. As to where are we going, I'm of a mixed feeling, and my feelings are very ambivalent. I know we have to have a certain amount of economic growth. We have to have opportunities to keep our young people here. All the years I've been in North Dakota, people have said our biggest export is of our talent. There's nothing to keep our young people here unless they work on the farm, but a lot of them have to go elsewhere to get an opportunity. So people say, well, we got to bring in new industry, broaden our tax base. We have a ready supply of labor here. We can give people tax breaks, and our weather isn't conducive. It frightens some people away. But we have to grow. Part of me says yes. But there's a part of me that says, I like being able to drive between Fargo and Bismarck and not be bumper to bumper with traffic. I like going to Lindenwood Park just down at the end of 18th Avenue from where we live in South Fargo with my grandkids, and there's a swing open for them to swing on, and there aren't a lot of, I mean, there are people there, but it's not crowded, and there are no shady characters there that I have to worry about abducting one of these kids or opening his trench coat when they're riding on the merry-go-round. And I like being able to get in my car and get anywhere I want to go in this city in 10 minutes. I like to go to a theater and not stand in line for 2 hours to get in. See, now those may be selfish things. A part of me says bigger is not necessarily better. At what price? Do we sacrifice our clean air? You know? Do we suddenly become crowded here? Does a crime rate go up? Is stress added to our lives? So I guess I don't want to just survive. I want to live. And I guess a part of me says that some of these things we do to survive. But just living, I mean, all these things I've mentioned, how do you put a price tag on those? So it's a difficult question to answer. Selfishly, I would like to have North Dakota always be pristine and clean and crime-free. I mean, people don't lock their houses at night sometimes. They don't lock their cars sometimes in little towns. A part of me likes that. But I would guess that this little secret we have, the 600 or so thousand of us who live here, I think, Jim, the word is getting out. Because every now and then I'll get a call on my talk show, and a guy say, I'm new in your area. And I would say, oh, where are you from? The guy said, from Connecticut, or from Los Angeles, or from Tallahassee, Florida. Well, how did you end up here? Well, you know, my wife was from Red Wing, Minnesota, and she said, gee, it's nice country back there, and had a job opportunity. We love it up here. Well, I mean, we wouldn't go back for anything. I said, how do you like our winters? Well, they're not so bad. So I think the secret's out. And I would imagine whenever this is taken out of a capsule and played, whether it's in the year 2000, 2020, 2030, you know, the people are projecting that the migration will be to the Sun Belt, and that by the year 2010, North Dakota will lose about 10 to 15% of its population. If those people are correct, 22 years from now when this tape is played, North Dakota's population should be less than 500,000. But if people have discovered this wonderful land that you and I love very much, we may be 1,000,000. Who knows? I don't know.
Well, thank you very much, Boyd, for a very graceful and illuminating interview. And on behalf of the Heritage Education Commission of Morehead State University, I want to thank you for your time. Do you have a real dependable joke, a yuck, that will really get the audience that you can come up with right now and wind up this thing with?
Well, my background is Norwegian. My father, whom I never knew, was German, and my mother is Norwegian, so I'm 50-50. So I'm not all stoic. There's a part of me, I guess it's the German part of me that does all the talking. And when I speak at banquets, I talk about growing up on a North Dakota farm. And one way I always test my audience to see if they're going to be with me, I tell the story of my Aunt Sigrid, one of the aunts. I mentioned that I was raised on two or three farms in the Rugby area. And then I say, as a matter of fact, I was a 4-H project for an older cousin. That usually gets a laugh. And when they laugh, I say, you can laugh if you like, but we got two reds and a blue at the fair one year. But the line I like is, I mentioned we didn't get to town very often in the 40s, and everything came out of a Sears catalog. And my Aunt Sigrid used to sit by the hour, very patiently, paging through that Sears catalog, admiring the new dresses and the fall stuff. And she'd bend a page back and make a note here. 2-3 hours, she'd look through that Sears catalog. And then when she got back up to the house, she'd write the order up. Well, at that point, if the people in the audience are farmers and have farm background, as most people in North Dakota do, they will know that I'm referring to what they call the outhouse. Now, I'm just curious as to how this joke will play in 2050, because it's going to be far removed. But in my day, the bathroom was a little what they called a two-holer, about 60 yards from the house, and you had to go out of doors and there in the wintertime to use this bathroom. And the other joke I tell is I remember it well because I had 7 older cousins and I was the youngest and had no seniority, and it was my job in the coldest days of February to go out there early in the morning and get the frost off so other people wouldn't have to do that. So the Norwegian jokes, as we call them, I don't tell Norwegian jokes per se. I tell stories about my ancestors and my relatives in North Dakota, many of whom were Norwegian, some of the things they did and some of the things they said, and it comes from pride. I'm not laughing at my family. I'm not laughing at the German Russians, who had a wonderful way of talking. We're laughing with them because this is the German Russians, 70,000 of whom came into this area at the turn of the century. They'd gone from Germany to Russia and then from Russia to the United States, and they had this wonderful way of talking. They would translate when they learned English, but they would translate in their mind from German to English, but they wouldn't rearrange the words, and they would say things like pump the horse in the trough, some water, or throw the cow over the fence, some hay. Or the older gentleman who lived south of Rugby and came to town after a blizzard and was at the Red Owl store. And one of the clerks said, Walter, how were the roads? And he said, roads hell. I drove 10 miles, stuck. These kinds of things. And they're funny and you laugh, but when you think about it, they're a marvelous record of the great people who came to this state in the early years, and whose all the people who live in other roots go back to those days, and people like to hear those stories because they're family, they're real people that they remember.
Thank you again, Boyd.